Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. An unusual aspect of World War II comes forward in The Cold Blue, coming to HBO June 6th, the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Filmmaker Aaron Nelson joins me next. In our next half hour, meet actor Benga Akinavi. His portrayal of Tom Robinson in the Broadway play version of To Kill a Mockingbird is winning raves, and now he's involved in DC Noir, one of 5 2019 Tribeca Film Festival pilot presentations as co-director. And after that encounter, we'll learn about Light Falls, the unique PBS special inspired by Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. We'll touch base with executive producer Tracy Day and an exclusive interview with renowned physicist Brian Greene. Also ahead, what will Game of Thrones creators do next in television? Steve Cross to Part 60 Minutes, and our classic trivia question. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker, and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Orville.com, proud development partner of the annual New York Television Festival, and the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get 3 free books when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the show. A wonderful Friday to you and all. 68 degrees at the top of the hour. Rain is gone. Sun is out. We're delighted to have you with us, wherever you're catching us, for the program All About Television. Night edition for you this Friday. A lot of good guests coming your way, so stay with us and be involved. How? Pick up the phone, dial in with this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country, around the world, here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. We've also got our chat room in business for you, so go ahead and use it. It's SimonApple04 by name, and you will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And anytime the program is on the air, you can connect others with Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk or Spreaker screen. Follow the instructions, other people will be live with you. Eric Nelson from The Cold Blue joins us live from Santa Cruz, California, after these news notes. Two questions come to mind about Sunday night's grand finale of Game of Thrones. One, how will this Emmy-winning saga end? Two, what new TV adventures will come from Game's executive producers, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss? On the second question, here's your answer. It depends on where this duo executive produced next. Benioff and Weiss have approached a number of programming ventures for a long-term development agreement covering both TV and film work. Among the interested parties are HBO, Disney, Apple, Netflix, and Amazon. In a few weeks, the duo will take on writing and producing the next set of Star Wars movies for Disney. Another TV chapter will close Sunday night. Steve Cross's tenure as 60 Minutes correspondent. After 30 seasons and more than 500 stories, Cross will retire from the CBS News Magazine and CBS News. His final segment this Sunday deals with a gigantic money laundering racket expose. Cross 60 Minutes' workload has been 8 to 10 segments a season in the last 2 years. The 73-year-old journalist will have an hour-long retrospective in his honor this September on CBS when 60 Minutes begins season number 52. Now some quickies before we get to our first guest. Dirty John's second season will run on USA Network instead of Bravo sometime in 2020. Black Sails co-creators John Steinberg and Dan Schott, remember that series on Starz, the pirate drama? They have a new 3-year association with Disney's Fox 21 TV studio. The pair's next TV creation is set for Apple TV Plus, and it's called C. Sharon Stone and rocker Marilyn Manson will become co-stars in The New Pope, the HBO sequel to its Young Pope miniseries of a year or two ago. And TV Globo, the Brazil-based television network that has worldwide exposure, will get into English-language series-making through a co-production pact with Sony. At least 3 scripted series will be created under this deal. And that is news notes for today. On June 6th, the 75th anniversary of D-Day will be celebrated, a turning point in World War II. And on that day, HBO will present a unique documentary that is sort of a documentary about a documentary. We'll get to that in a moment with our guests. But here's the thing, if you can't wait until HBO presents the show, June 6th, or if you're not an HBO subscriber, you're in luck. Next week, you'll have an opportunity to see this film, perhaps at your local theater. Joining us live from Santa Cruz, California, is the filmmaker behind The Cold Blue, Eric Nelson. Eric, thanks for coming on.
Pleasure to be on.
Eric, talk about the making of this. It sounds like a documentary about World War II, about, in most respects, a documentary about World War II.
It is an interesting hybrid. In 1943, William Wyler a card-carrying, brilliant film director, a man idolized by, among other directors, Steven Spielberg, volunteered and went overseas to do his service and when he was in his 40s and flew 5 combat missions with the 8th Air Force at a time when the survival rate was 25% lived, 75% died. And Wyler went and flew combat missions to gather documentary footage for a film that became The Memphis Belle that was released in 1944, 75 years ago. We discovered in the National Archives all of the footage that Wyler risked his life to film, and one of his cameramen died filming. 15 hours of color, raw footage of B-17s and the life and death activities of the pilots and crews. And out of that 15 hours, we constructed a brand new film, a reboot, if you will, but a completely new film out of Wyler's material, working with the Wyler estate. So we had the blessings of his family to do this. So in essence, it carries the story of the Memphis Belle forward into the 21st century.
How did you do that? What the film depicts brings it into or makes it contemporary for our time?
Well, life and death, risking your lives on insane combat missions is unfortunately not a thing of the total past. And what's unique about this film is the raw footage, the camera loads that the guys shot, the cinematographers, all of whom are from Hollywood, is extraordinary documentary footage and shot very much as if it was shot today. So we, in constructing a new film, we deployed the footage very much in the 21st century style. And as the footage, due to the technical limitations, you couldn't bring a sound crew up in a B-17, the footage was silent. There's no sound on the footage. So we worked with a gentleman who came off a project called Black Panther. It was the sound designer of the Black Panther. And we recorded in a real B-17 for 4 days and re-recorded the sounds of 1943. And in addition, we spoke, and this is key to the project, we did a last call interview with a composite crew, 9 guys who are now in their 90s who flew in World War II on B-17s. And it's their narrative that takes us through the film. So it's very much, I would say, you could say it's in the spirit of Peter Jackson's They Shall Not Grow Old. Our film actually was released earlier, but it's startling to me how close those two films are in kind of feel. One's about World War I, and ours is a color film about World War II.
Mm-hmm. We have a person in our chat room, by the way, SimonApple04 by name. So if you have a question or comment, put it in the room or give us a call, 646-652-2906. William Wyler, whose film credits include everything from Ben-Hur to The Best Years of Our Lives. I want to talk more about that because it was the Memphis Belle, the making of that documentary, that led to a very important decision that Wyler made for that Oscar-winning Best Picture of 1947. But he was one of several famed film directors, probably Capra another one, who went overseas to World War II to be with the troops and to document what was going on. How was Wyler's mission similar or different to what Capra and the other filmmakers went through in World War II?
Well, very different, because I don't believe Capra ever left the country. Capra did his films in Culver City. John Huston went overseas. George Stevens went overseas. I don't think Capra did. But what Wyler's mission, Wyler was way more exposed on these 5 flights. 1943, April, May, 75 years ago, almost to the day when he was filming the Memphis Belle, it was an very hazardous time. It was the most dangerous period of the 8th Air Force air war over Germany. The Germans had the edge over everything, and fighters could not escort them over Germany. So he was completely exposed. And being Jewish and being a famous director, had Wyler been shot down, had been captured by the Nazis, one can only imagine what would have happened to him. So the risk he took, I think, and I think his colleague directors at the time would all agree, were he put himself farther in the line of fire than anybody.
And incidentally, those directors who did go overseas, they were put together with Capra, I believe, a series of films called Why We Fight, which I know.
Well, those were Capra's. Capra did Why We Fight. That was the Capra series, which was composed of archive footage, you know, gathered around the world. Houston went over to do the Battle of San Pietro. John Ford was at Midway. George Stevens was there for the liberation, I believe, of Dachau or Buchenwald, but he was on the ground. And Weiler actually lost his hearing for life in his right ear in a mission a few months later after completing the Memphis Belle. He was in a B-25 and went deaf, and for the rest of his life had no hearing in one of his ears. And if you're a director, that is not a good thing.
We're speaking with Eric Nelson. He is the filmmaker behind a new presentation on HBO coming up on June 6th, the 75th anniversary of D-Day. It's called The Cold Blue. And if you're not an HBO subscriber, and guess what? You have a chance to see this movie earlier than June 6th. By the way, the June 6th screening is at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. And we'll tell you about that in our next segment. Eric is with us live from Santa Cruz, California this half hour. On Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Appel with you live from New York. Have you with us Friday afternoon on the program All About Television. And to question or comment for our guest, put the call in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Earlier today, Netflix launched its latest original series. It's called It's Bruno. It's created, executive produced, written, and directed out of Bushwick, Brooklyn by one person. His name is Sovan Naim. You will hear him Monday, 3:50 New Pacific on Tomorrow Be Televised. We'll talk to him about this very unique man and dog project. And we'll also find out about the deal he just made with Netflix to produce in Brooklyn a hip-hop musical film based on Romeo and Juliet. Sovan Naim, live with us exclusively Monday, 3:50 New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Before we get to the unique way that people can see this film in their movie theaters, why the Memphis? How painstaking was it to get that film from the Memphis Belle and make it suitable for television?
Well, we had 15 hours of material to deal with. It had to be brought up from the basement of the National Archives, which I always envisioned looking something like the last scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, piles and piles of footage. Bring it up, take it out of its original film cans with a white-gloved technician and transfer it from its original raw crumbling self to 4K, digital 4K, and just get it across before the film deteriorated. So that was quite a process and took months just to physically get the film transferred. But once the film was transferred, we were able to remove dirt that was on the cameras at the time they filmed it. Weiler had accidentally damaged, or a technician working with him had damaged and scratched all of his negative footage back in 1943. So there were scratches in every version of the Memphis Belle ever made that we were able to digitally remove. And because it was in 4K, we were able to take it from a 3x4 old school TV, you know, square ratio, and turn it into widescreen, big screen TV, or theatrical ratio without any loss of quality, which in an historical documentary is very unusual. So, the process was painstaking but worth it, and the footage looks better than it ever did, and that's including when it was on the Moviola in England in 1943, because he had scratched it then.
Hmm. Eric, when you talked to the bombers who you were able to get for this film, how vividly could they recall what happened to them in World War II and the scene that they went through?
Well, I asked questions different than they're used to being asked. Often they like to tell war stories. I got here and I flew here and we did this and I went out here on this date and we were part of this mission. What I was asking them was more general questions. How cold was it? What did flak sound like? What did you have for breakfast? The details that people usually don't ask but are incredibly relevant to the story we wanted to tell, because this isn't about a mission or a historical documentary that walks you through all the sometime boring historical details. This is much more an experiential film, not unlike Dunkirk, which kind of puts you in the middle of the battle, and it really didn't tell you the story of Dunkirk. It was more about what it was like to be there and experience it, and that was very much in the back of my mind making The Cold Blue.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned, Eric, for people who don't have HBO or don't want to wait till June 6th to see this, thanks to the fine folks at Fathom Events, they can go, if the local movie theater is a Fathom participant, they can go next week to see the film.
And I suggest everyone see it both ways, because the film that's being shown next week will be on a big, big movie screen with a full immersive surround sound that I'm sure some people will have when they watch television, but a lot of people don't. And it also will contain a short film at the beginning. We made a discovery in the Bundesarchiv, the film archives in Berlin, of a Nazi newsreel that was made, wait for it, in the spring of 1944, at the same time, the same 75 years ago to the month, that shows from the German perspective them shooting down B-17s. And it's utterly harrowing. I've never seen anything like it, because it's cameras that were mounted in German fighters as they celebrate shooting down Americans. And it really gives you a visceral sense of what it was like to fly. That's only going to be in theaters next week, as well as a behind-the-scenes, a making of The Cold Blue, featuring we had the privilege of screening The Cold Blue last October for a 8th Air Force reunion. So we screened it for 20 to the 20 or 30 guys who are left or can make it to a reunion. We screened The Cold Blue, and this film has their reaction to the film that you've just seen. So the ideal punch is to see it on the Fathom event on the 23rd, tell all your friends, and then watch it again on HBO with your DVR going so you can save it. That would be being the director, that's how I would like it to be done.
How are you able to get the deal with Fathom? Because when you think of Fathom, you think of them doing special events like the Metropolitan Opera or cultural events or other things. This is the first time I've heard of Fathom actually presenting a documentary. How are you able to get the arrangement?
Well, you're missing a big one. Fathom are the people who brought Peter Jackson's They Shall Not Grow Old out. And I was watching, I became aware of the Peter Jackson film. We had finished The Cold Blue and had premiered it, and then I found out that Peter Jackson was doing a film that was very similar. It sounded in execution and intent to what I was doing, and Fathom was releasing it. So when Fathom put it out in December, it attracted a surprisingly huge audience, not surprising to me, but surprising to a lot of other people. So I reached out to Fathom to say, we happen to have a film that would reach the same audience who just showed up for the Peter Jackson film, as I believe this film does. So Fathom really, they took a chance on the film, but they had the track record and success of They Shall Not Grow Old. So, and then since the Jackson film, Apollo 11 has come out, which again is kind of what I call big screen history. It's a whole new genre of documentary. All three of the films have ravishing footage from the past with immersive soundtracks and are constructed very much using the latest technology. So there's kind of a unofficial trilogy here, with A Cold Blue being the third to be available and the first to be screened. It's a perfect fit, I think, for Fathom and for the audience of the Peter Jackson film.
And good for them, by the way, to expand the availability of documentaries in movie theaters, which is something that, with some rare exceptions, has not happened. Same with short subjects. So it's great to see somebody really out there advocating documentary presentations on the big screen. And the documentary we're talking about is The Cold Blue. It will be running on May 23rd at Fathom Events affiliated theaters all over the country, and it will be on June 6th on HBO, 8 p.m. Pacific time, on the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Eric Nelson is the filmmaker behind The Cold Blue. He joins us live from Santa Cruz, California, this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Apple will be live from New York. Delighted you're with us, wherever you're catching us on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and the iHeart Radio Podcast Network. We have a few more minutes with Eric, so make a call, be part of the program, and interact with us at 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Next week, we have three episodes coming your way, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, all at this very hour, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific. And on Wednesday's special episode, We will meet the people behind a new Facebook Watch series called Family Style. It's from Stage 13, the digital project division of Warner Brothers. We will meet the acclaimed chef who put the show together. He's the executive producer, Philip Chang. And from Stage 13, we'll have the vice president of unscripted development, Shari Soares. Plus, we'll talk diversity and where it is going in the world of TV with one of our favorite guests on the subject, the former head of marketing at Oxygen, Linda Ong, currently chief culture officer from Pacific Entertainment Group. She was supposed to be on our show today, could not do it, so we're having it rescheduled for Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. I mentioned the best years of our lives earlier, and that's because I understand during the making of the Memphis Belle, or shortly after, that's where William Wyler met Harold Russell, the extraordinary soldier who lost his arms in World War II, who decided that, hey, I can be a very special actor in a film about people coming home from the war called The Best Years of Our Lives. Do you cover that at all in the film?
No, and Wyler had already decided to make and was deep into pre-production on Best Years of Our Lives, where he saw a documentary that the Defense Department had made about disabled veterans, and Harold Russell was in that documentary, and Wyler was struck by his camera presence and cast him as a result of that, and then literally trained him as an actor, and he would wind up winning an Academy Award for that, as did William Wyler for Best Years of Our Lives. And it's interesting you bring up that film, because I really see, and the Wyler family, Catherine Wyler, his oldest daughter, agrees with me that there's, we call it the B-17 trilogy now. You have The Memphis Belle, then 3 years later, Best Years of Our Lives, and then 70 years after that, The Cold Blue, all revolving around Wyler's experiences in World War II and B-17s. So, you know, obviously my film is nowhere near the masterpieces that those two films are, but it does pay the story forward into the 21st century.
Yeah. You can often see The Best Years of Our Lives on Turner Classic Movies. If you've never seen it, I believe it's, for me, it's one of the top five films I've ever seen in my life. I think it's one of the most extraordinary, I think it's still the best movie about veterans of a war coming home and trying to assimilate themselves in society. It is brilliantly put together with wonderful cinematography by the great Greg Toland, who did Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. I'm so shocked he never had an Oscar nomination for it. In addition to the fact Harold Russell's performance. By the way, he is still the only actor ever to win two Oscars for the same role. He won for the role of South Best Supporting Actor, but he also won for being a tremendous honor, or to actually say, a tremendous role model, excuse me, for veterans coming home from World War II. And he's still there. And the performance, I think, is extraordinary. The scene, by the way, where he has to give up his hooks to show his girlfriend what it's like to be without arms, played by Kathy O'Donnell, is still one of the most moving scenes I've ever seen in a film. And it really is extraordinary. And I want to ask you, how did Wyler's experience making The Memphis Belle and being in World War II, how did it impact how he did The Best Years of Our Lives?
Well, there would be no Best Years of Our Lives if he wasn't conversant with the guys he met and he stayed in touch with. When the Memphis Belle guys came home and did their tour, their homecoming tour, he invited them all over to the Wyler house, the Wyler mansion, for dinner, and told them, name your favorite star and I'll invite her. And they all gave their dream list, and every one of them, one of the female stars, showed up for the dinner. And Catherine remembers that. She was a little girl at the time, but she remembers the party downstairs. So Wyler was haunted by his experience. He was disabled because he lost his hearing during his experience. And you know the scene at the end where the flashback sequence where the guy crawls into the turret and imagines this, you know, that was a direct result of Wyler having been in a V-17 flying, because he knew what it was like to be in one of those things flying. And he improvised that scene. I don't know if you know this, but he literally improvised the scene. They had the location, they showed up, they set up the cameras, and Wyler winged it and did that amazing scene and then knew the sound design to put in at the end. None of that would have happened had he not flown the missions he flew in 1943.
Yeah, and I want to give credit to Dana Andrews, who should have got an Oscar nomination for that performance, who is the guy who plays Fred Derby in The Turret, Greg Toll in the cinematography, and Hugo Freehoff for the music and the sound design people as well. And Daniel Mendel, I believe, who did the film editing on the film. Just marvelous. And if you ever get a chance to see The Best of All, like, do. Fly. Don't walk. Fly to see that film on Turner Classic Movies. And stay with it the entire time. You will be very well rewarded. As I said, it's one of the best movies, I think, ever made. And the best movie still, 70 years plus after it was made, that deals with the subject of veterans coming home and trying to reestablish themselves in society. Eric, before we let you go, what do you hope people get from seeing your documentary, whether they see it on HBO, see it at Fathom in the theater, or both ways?
I want them to reconnect with the past. This film is a time travel device to bring people back to 1943. There's no mediation in here. The goal is to get people back in time and to reconnect with the men who saved the world. It was a very different America. It was a very different world. And these are the last living links to that time. And this is a chance on Memorial Day and on the D-Day anniversary of D-Day to celebrate what they did and to pay their story forward into a new generation. So I think it's important that they're remembered, celebrated, and you really get a sense of what these guys did to save the world back in
between 1944. On June 6th, the 70th anniversary of D-Day, HBO will present The Cold Blue. They will lead off primetime with it at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Check your list for where HBO is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details, look for them online at HBO.com. However, if you don't have HBO and you want to see it earlier and see it on your neighborhood screen, check out Fathom Events' presentation of that film, The Cold Blue, on May 23rd. Go to fathomevents.com, find out if there's a movie theater playing in your area that will play the film. The times may be different depending on where you are around the country, around the world, and check it out at www.fathomevents.com. I think you will be well rewarded. Eric Nelson, the filmmaker behind The Cold Blue, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on making the film and on the double presentation, both on HBO and on Fathom. It's been a delight to have you with us, and a very, very good, and all the very best success. And by the way, one other thing, are you working on any new projects coming up, Bill Moore TV?
Yes, trying to push the, now that we've discovered this treasure trove of Nazi German newsreels, which give this unbelievably different, harrowing, and vital look at World War II. We're looking at doing a new film based on that in essence explores the original fake news and looks at how a nation could do the worst things for what they thought were the best reasons. So it's a very harrowing, dark ride, but we're putting that project together as we speak. It's sort of the evil twin of The Cold Blue, if you will.
Got it. Eric, thank you again for coming aboard. All the very best to you and this film and your career going forward. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Eric Nelson, the filmmaker of The Cold Blue on HBO and your local movie theater, perhaps through Fathom Events, joining us live from Santa Cruz, California. More tomorrow with televised coming your way, but first some words from the fine folks at Audible.com. As mentioned before, this Sunday night, the big finale of Game of Thrones, but it doesn't have to be a finale if you get Audible.com, because the Game of Thrones books by George R. R. Martin are available to you with a trial offer that lasts a month and maybe could last a lifetime. You know, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment information, inspiration too. There's over 108,000 titles to choose from, including most of the George R. R. Martin Game of Thrones books in audio form, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and IR Radio. And that's not all. There's a growing group of Audible Originals titles that includes one-man, one-woman shows, regional theater, off-Broadway and Broadway productions, and original audio work, especially for Audible. And don't forget, you get great customer service when you have Audible.com because of its parent company, Amazon.com. So don't forget, for a one-month trial, you get three free audio books, two of them Audible Originals. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/televised and hear for yourself why Audible.com will transform the way you hear the world. Coming up in the next half hour, our question of the week. But first, the acclaimed actor in the Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird. You've also seen him on the HBO series The Deuce, and before that on The Wire. And I was working with the key people on The Wire and The Deuce in a brand new pilot project, DC Noir, that was presented last month at Rekha Film Festival. Benny Akinami will join us live from the Big Apple, where he is performing tonight, I believe, at To Kill a Mockingbird. And we'll do that after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. If you're connected to the best internet radio in the galaxy, www.blogtalkradio.com. And Spreaker.com. And don't forget, there's over 35 million listeners tuned into both services around the world every month. VTR is your home for Sports Time Radio. Check it out today, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. Remember, that's VTR available 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to part two of our 90-minute Barbie Televised extravaganza coming away this Friday afternoon. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. More great guests coming away in the hour ahead. Happy to have you aboard, whether you're checking us out on Spreaker or Blog Talk Radio or the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. If you have a question or comment for our guests ahead, ring it in, 646-652-2906. Or go to our chat room, SimonApple04, but we already have one person in the room. My next guest is somebody you've seen on television in a lot of different roles, especially in the roles created by David Simon in his award-winning series, The Wire, and more recently, The Deuce, which will wrap up its third year and final year on HBO later this year, produced here in New York. But lately, he has won rave reviews for his performance as Tom Robinson in the new Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird, written by Aaron Sorkin, directed by Bartlett Sher. And that's where we find him right now. Why? Because recently, he got into directing as co-director of a pilot that was recently presented at the Rekha Film Festival from George Poliakonos, one of the key writer producers on The Wire, Treme, and The Deuce. And the pilot, which was done out of Washington, D.C., is called, appropriately, D.C. Noir. Joining me now here in New York, an area exclusive, Benge Akinabi. Yeah. Benge, great to have you here.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome, Benge. First of all, how are things going with To Kill a Mockingbird? Because you're at the theater. What theater, by the way, is it playing?
It's at the Schubert Theater on 44th Street, and it's been amazing. The reception has been amazing and humbling.
So let's get to DC Noir. This is your first shot, I believe, at directing in television. Why did you decide to take it?
Well, I love working with George. He produced and wrote it. The story. I love DC. I was born in DC, and there were four segments to this project, and each of the directors, including George, who directed the different segments, all have ties from in the DC, Maryland, Virginia area. And I've been working with you know, George since for a long time. So it just seemed like a natural fit to be able to get the opportunity to do it and just seize it.
Mm-hmm. What makes George tick as a writer producer? And he's one of David Simon's proteges. He had done other work before deciding to get into television. And he has built up a great track record with David on the shows you've been involved with, The Wire, Treme, and now The Deuce.
I mean, George is a great novelist as well. So he's been a creator for a long time before working with David. I think they bring out some really great stuff, great storytelling styles in one another. What makes him tick is that he tries to tell good, strong, honest stories and make complete characters as far as the portrayals of people, and that registers with David. It registers with other people who George has worked with for years, and apparently it registers with audiences.
Yeah, I understand that DC Noir is taken from his short stories that deal with unique characters in the world of the nation's capital. And did you have a pick of which story you would do? There are four of them that were put together in pilot form. Did you have a pick of which one to do, and which one did you pick?
Yeah, so the stories all, almost all the stories come from one of George's last books called The Martini Shot, which was a collection of novellas. And so George took three of them, and then he created a new story, a new fourth story, and that was the one he directed. And so by the time I came on, one had already been shot, and I think the majority of them had already been allocated, including the fact that George was writing a new one for himself to direct. So The one I got was like one of the ones. They were all great. I loved them, and so the one I got was one of the ones that I was one of my favorite ones. So I was lucky to get that one. But yeah, that's how I ended up on the one that I got to direct.
And the one's called Strong Music.
String music.
String music, excuse me.
String music, like the sound that that's made when a basketball goes through a hoop.
Mm-hmm. And what's the plot about?
This young man named Antonio lives in this neighborhood that's it's pretty tough in D.C. And you know, everyone puts on, you know, you have to put on your armor just like going from one block to the next in this neighborhood. But he's not like everyone else in this neighborhood. He's a more sensitive guy. He's considered soft, and so that. That then there's nothing wrong with that, except like in this neighborhood that you could be marked as a potential victim. So he puts on his armor, but there's an antagonist in the film, played by Wale, who sees that this guy isn't, you know, as tough as he says he is, or thinks pretends he is, and so yeah, he's a bully. But this guy's just, but you know, Antonio's just trying to get through the day. You know, it's him, his mom, and his sister, and the bullies are determined to make sure that Antonio does not get through the day.
Mm-hmm. So coming into this as a first time directing a TV pilot or television period, what's your game plan going in, and how did, as you were directing, how did the game plan evolve?
Try to make the day, because you have a certain amount of scenes and some amount of hours. Not enough hours to match the amount of scenes you have, and you still need to shoot enough to be able to tell your story. And you're dealing with all these different elements and different departments on the set that have that theoretically are there to help get the story told, but they all have their own you know, priorities, and sometimes their priorities are contrary to yours. So there's a lot of negotiating that goes on a set in order to get this you know director's vision. Done and shot through a camera, so it's been that was a really dope experience, and I'm glad that it was shot as a feature anthology consisting of four films, and it, you know, it's obviously plays well as a pilot as well in TV show, so I'm glad it's being received so well. The fact that we got to Tribeca with String Music was like an honor.
And we're going to talk about the feedback from the film festival presentation. But by the way, we have another person that just joined our chat room, two people in the room right now. So welcome aboard. If you have a question or comment for our guest, please get in the room so we can get on the air, or give us a call, 646-652-2906. I understand that you use local film crews in this pilot, as well as the other three shows too, and also that you had interns from Howard University involved in different capacities. How are they utilized? How did you work with your crew, and how did you work with the people at Howard?
Some of the interns from Howard were crew members. They would help out with grips or you know, crafty, or they wanted to learn as much as they could about being on a film crew, and they gave their all, because it wasn't easy shooting a project. You know, with the long hours and, you know, early mornings, late nights, and it's not easy, especially for the crew. And we had like amazing interns from Howard who just like, they just worked very hard and were determined to soak up as much information as possible. We did as much casting as we could from the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. We really wanted to highlight the talent there, and we wanted to highlight not just the talent in front of the camera, but the talent behind the camera. We got a lot of great support from the Film Commission in D.C., so we wanted to do as much as possible to kind of like show what D.C. could do.
We are live at the Schubert Theater on Broadway with Bain Akinabi. He is not only the co-star of the acclaimed Broadway production, Tony nominated as well, I might add, To Kill a Mockingbird, from Aaron Sorkin and Jeff Daniels, directed by Bartlett Sher, And he's also one of the directors of DC Noir, which recently was one of the 5 pilot season TV pilots presented at the Tribeca Film Festival. And he is with us live this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon Knapp, I'm with you live also in Nueva York. Happy to have you aboard. You have a question or comment for Benga? Don't be shy. Ring it in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Earlier today, Netflix premiered its latest original series. It's called It's Bruno. It's a very unique man and his dog tale that was produced here in New York, the Bushwick section of Brooklyn, to be specific. And Monday on Tomorrow Be Televised, we will meet the one person who put it all together as creator, executive producer, writer, director, and co-star. His name is Solomon Kine. And yesterday, he just got a deal with Netflix to produce and co-write a new hip-hop musical based on Romeo and Juliet. Guess where it'll be shot? In the Bushwick section of Brooklyn. Solomon Kine, you will meet him live and exclusive Monday, 3:30 New Pacific. He's one of the hottest new talents in television. We'll have him for you Monday on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Benga, when you were working with your actors, what kind of things did you do to get the best performances out of them?
We had the script as a roadmap, which was great. So just getting their opinions on as far as what they thought the characters wanted out of the scene, and then helping to guide them into getting that. So obviously, so I could also get the shots I needed to tell the overall story. Just encouraging them to live these characters as real as possible, and not there's no need to sensationalize what the circumstances are, as high as they are, and just letting them feel comfortable just being.
And with DC Noir, because there were 4 segments, there were 3 other directors, including George Pelicanos, the creator. Did any of them come to work with you on your segment, and vice versa, did you have a chance to work with them on their segment?
No, all the directors worked on their own segments. George, obviously, as the producer and writer, worked on all the segments with the directors. The other directors, that's my Wire family. Like, I've known them for a long time since I started doing The Wire. The other two directors, like, I've seen them grow up as kids. So they'd come out and support, which was really awesome of them. So, like, they were around, but as far as they had to work on the project, so all the directors, did their own short films/episodes. But we're there as far as for moral support and to bounce the ideas off of.
Mm-hmm. Did you have good weather for shooting the episode?
It did. I did. I didn't have much time, so I did. So I'm glad that we had good weather for the few days that we had. But we did have good weather. Some days too good, because I wanted, like, one day in particular, I wanted overcast skies. And it was, the sun was just, it was too nice and too bright that day, so we shot it as is.
And where do you shoot in D.C.?
We shot different locations. We shot across from Howard. The names are now escaping me. We shot all over D.C. We did a lot of location scouting, which was really cool. The first part of the scouting for me was going to a lot of the different basketball leagues to scout some basketball players for the 2 big basketball scenes. So they had brought me to a number of different leagues to find some basketball players, some really talented basketball players, to just carry out some of the choreography on the court for when we shot. So we were all over D.C. For that, and also scouting locations.
Mm-hmm. So fast forward to having this presented at Tribeca, what kind of feedback did you get, first from the audience overall, but did you have any directors come up to you and say X, Y, Z?
Oh, you mean as far as feedback?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been overwhelmingly really positive, which is great, because we had a great time making the project. And so to premiere at Tribeca, I live in New York. I've been here for years, and so Tribeca is like an important festival to us, not just the world, but particularly to New Yorkers. and to have this DC film with my DC crew and like so well received here. You know, a number of writers came up, a number of producers, so and talked about, you know, what they had seen. And we wanted to show DC, like, and see what DC could do. And I think we did that.
Mm-hmm. The pilot season that Tribeca did last year actually turned out to be very successful. I know that one pilot is now being developed as a series. I think it was the second one also. What's happened since? Has anyone come up to George or you saying, let's turn this into a weekly series and let's do it somewhere, whether it's Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, Apple, Disney, Warner Media, you know, somewhere?
There are some talks. I can't get into too much of that. But there are some talks about DC Noir, possibly having a life, moving forward.
And how does directing experience leave you? Do you feel like, okay, one and done, or do you want to do more directing? And if you did, what kind of, whether on DC Noir or someplace else, are you game for giving another go?
I loved it. It really works a different part of my brain and my creativity, and I'd love to do more of it, especially like work with worthy projects like DC Noir. So it's something that I definitely want to do more of.
Mm-hmm. Incidentally, if you want to catch DC Noir as all four episodes, you can do it at this website. It's www.dcnoirmovie.com. It's www.dcnoirmovie.com. And we'll keep you posted, by the way, if it does become a series. Incidentally, we are trying to get George Pelicanos on the program, hopefully sometime in the next week or two. And also, you should know that he is also working on the third and final season of The Deuce, produced here in New York on HBO, which will be running on that network later this year. We are speaking with Zeid Akinabi. In addition to what he did with DC Noir, you can catch him with the Schubert Theater in the acclaimed Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird. We'll talk more about that next. And if you have a question or comment for Banger right now here on New Army Televised, make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room. Time at Apple 04 by name. Coming out next Friday, our third of three episodes next week on the Marvel Televised, we'll talk about a brand new 30-for-3 documentary on ESPN called Qualified. The Indianapolis 500 is coming up, first time on NBC, by the way. And one of the people who made the Indy 500 happen a long time ago was the person who broke the gender barrier there, Janet Guthrie. What's happened to her since? That's the subject of Qualified. We'll have the producer, Caroline Wardlow, next Friday, 3:30 New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Tell you, how did you win the role of Tom Robinson on To Kill a Mockingbird?
I was a part of the workshop. I was asked to be a part of a 2-day workshop, not this past October, but the October before, at Lincoln Center. I didn't know much about what it was going to be. I knew Aaron Sorkin was involved, and I knew it was Lincoln Center, and so that was enough for me to want to be part of the workshop. And then the workshop went really well. It's funny because it was while I was scouting and doing scout. I left D.C. while I was scouting for D.C. Noir to come up and do the workshop, and then went back down to D.C. But it was an amazing process. And then sometime after the workshop, the producer emailed me and asked if I wanted to do it with them on Broadway. I was like, in a year, and I was like, what? And yeah, so then now we're here.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, going in, a lot of people would wonder how similar this would be to the movie version of To Kill a Mockingbird, which is still resonates with so many people. You see it often on Turner Classic Movies. It's one of the great films of the 60s. Gregory Peck's performance as Atticus Finch is his Oscar-winning performance and one of his best. But also the role of Tom, beautifully played by Brock Peters, an actor who a lot more people should know about. I think one of the best actors in the 60s and 70s. So many good films. I think he was very underrated in this movie. I thought he should have won an Oscar nomination, by the way, for it. Did you have a chance to see Brock Peters' performance? And if you did, how did it influence the way you played Tom?
I saw excerpts of it as a child, and he was brilliant. Which is the main reason why I did not watch it when preparing for this role. I couldn't do this. Like we didn't take the book and put the book on stage. Like we're fortunate enough to have an amazing playwright in Aaron Sorkin who created a new project based off the book, and so I wanted to, like, I knew I could come up here and try to do my best Brock Peters, and that would be the cool road to failure. So I haven't watched the movie in its entirety, actually, I think ever, but last time I saw any of it was as a child. And after I'm done with this project, I'm looking forward to watching the film, but, like, I had to make sure that my performance was based off of what we did during that developmental process.
It's a beautiful movie, up and down the line. All the actors, the beautiful direction by Robert Mulligan, the wonderful theme music by Lou Bernstein, the opening title sequence, Robert Duvall's performance as Boo Radley, Mary Badham with her Oscar-nominated performance as Scout. Just everything up and down the line is marvelous. And we should point out that this play is not an adaptation of the movie. This is its own work by Aaron Sorkin, taken right from the source, the book by Harper Lee.
Yeah, and I mean, we have one of the greatest writers alive right now to work to adapt or make a new play out of one of the greatest American novels. It's an abundance of riches and creativity. So it was I was very fortunate. I am very fortunate. It's kind of an incredible thing.
Mm-hmm. And what's been the reaction from the audience, knowing that for many of them, they still have that striking image of the film?
They've been moved. It's like it's amazing at the curtain call to see so many people in tears and just on their feet. It's kind of a humbling. It's not kind of. It is a humbling experience. You get used to doing the play. We love doing it, and it's amazing. But we know this play very well. We've been doing it now for a long time. So then we see the audience out there who are now seeing it for the first time and see how they're moved by it. It's wild to see, and we're part of an experience with this audience, their first experience with the play, and so it's very touching.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, tell us about how things are going with The Deuce, working on the third and final season. You're one of the co-stars of it. What's it been like?
What's that?
What's it been like working on the third season of The Deuce?
I can't say too much about it, but The Deuce is amazing. Like it's. I've been working creatively with this group of people for over a decade on one way or another. So it's when you get to work on a David Simon show or George Pelicanus show, and these are people you actually like and respect, and you're doing work that you're proud of. It's like in the city that I love. I love New York, and we're talking about a time period that was before my time, but I've heard so much about. It's just a dream project to do right now.
Mm-hmm. And of course, New York is more and more becoming a major production capital, and in all five boroughs, by the way, here in Brooklyn, Queens, all over the place. And it's great to see New York television production better than ever, and a lot of great talents, including yourselves and the people working on The Deuce, David and George and so forth, putting it all together. Anyway, if you want to catch DC Noir, all four episodes, and in movie form, here's where you go online, www.dcnoirmovie.com. That's www.dcnoirmovie.com. And if you're in town, do not walk. Go and see the acclaimed Broadway production of To Kill a Mockingbird with our guest, Bengay Abnabi, in the role of Tom Robinson. And, of course, Jeff Daniels plays Atticus Finch. Written by Aaron Sorkin, director of Broadway Share, is a must-see. And I'm happy to say also Tony nominated as well. It's playing at the Schubert Theater. So make sure you check out the Schubert Theater's website for all the details. And The Deuce will come back for its third and final season on HBO later this year. HBO.com has more information. Domenico Minardi, thank you very, very much for being with us. Congratulations on your work with Tom Robinson and on GCR. I hope it becomes a series. We'd love to have you back if it does. And all the very best to you and all the people at the Schubert Theater for making a tremendous production of To Kill a Mockingbird happen.
Thank you so much for having me on the show and giving such love to DC Noir and To Kill a Mockingbird. And hopefully you get a chance to see the play. I'll be doing it for another 5 months. So you know, please come out and have everyone you know should come out and check this play out. It's a very important piece.
Thank you, Wiggle, for sure. It is important, and it is a must-see, and we really appreciate you taking the time before your next performance to be with us. It's been a pleasure. All the greatest to you and everybody in the cast.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Take care.
Thank you, Naganami, joining us live from the Schubert Theater in Broadway, where he is creating Tom Robinson in the acclaimed production of To Kill a Mockingbird, and also one of the directors of DC Noir, one of the Tribeca Film Festival pilot season pilots. And again, we will try to get George Pelicanos, the writer, producer, and creator of DC Noir, and, of course, one of the key writers on and producers on The Wire, Treme, and the Deuce with us on a future episode in the next week or two. Now it's time for our classic trivia question of the week. If you know the answer, we've got two prizes in play, both books. Gentleman Jack, based on the current HBO original series, On the Real, and Lister by Ann Schoen, with a foreword by Sally Rainwright, the creator and executive producer of the series who was on this program several weeks ago. And Delta-5 by Daniel Suarez. Many people in the know call him the new Michael Crichton of science fiction, speculative fiction writers. Here's the question. We've had it since a week ago Monday, and we're going to keep it posted to the weekend. We're going to try to get another winner. And here is the question. Name one of two actors starring in the same role on the Western series Cult 45. Name one of two actors starring in the same role on the TV Western Cult 45, produced by Warner Brothers from 1957 to 1960, running on ABC. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to include in your email your name and your full name and address, so if you win, we can get the prizes to you. And if you missed the question a moment ago, we'll try to post it again before we wrap up at around 4:30 Eastern Time, 1:30 Pacific, or if not, first thing tomorrow morning on Facebook and on my Twitter feed at UBC Simon TWBT. That's at UBC Simon TWBT. Want to thank all the 7-plus followers of our feed. We give them news notes on what's happening, special coverage of TV events, all sorts of great stuff. So check out Twitter, UBC Simon TWBT. Over 700 people do, and we really appreciate each and every one of you. So once again, be part of our classroom question of the week. Remember, in order to win, you got to play in. So do so, and all the very best. This is Tomorrow We Televised, the program all about the two. Happy to have you with us this Friday afternoon. It's getting super bright and nice and sunny out there. It was raining a little bit. This, by the way, I believe this is the 8th straight Friday that New York and metro area has had rain, and the 7th straight day that rain has been part of the forecast. But guess what? It's going to be an absolutely beautiful weekend, and that's great because tomorrow, one of my favorite days of the year, the New York Dance Parade is happening. Danceparade.org, check it out. And check out the 10,000 dancers from all over the place who will be going down Broadway from 21st Street starting at 1 p.m. local time. And they'll be going through Union Square, University Place, then take a turn south on 8th Street all the way down to 1st Avenue, where at the park located there, there'll be all sorts of special performances and special events. It's the annual New York Dance Parade. It is happening. It'll be heard, by the way, by Spectrum New York One News. And if you're in town, do check it out. It's a wonderful sight for the eyes, ears, and for the mind, too. And the Dance Parade. Also, a shout-out to all the winners of the Peabody Awards. They will be recognized tomorrow night at Cipriani Wall Street. I'll be on the red carpet there. Looking forward to it. Some of the people we have interviewed on this program, the executive producer of Killing Eve, also Michael Rose, the executive producer and creator of The Good Place, which won this year. Rita Moreno, the co-star of One Day at a Time, Goldie Comer on Color, and Mike Royce, the executive of that series, ran 3 seasons on Netflix with Norman Lear. She is winning a special Lifetime Achievement Award. Hope to see her there, and we'll discuss them One Day at a Time and see if, by the way, the latest word is that CBS is interested in putting One Day at a Time on. They are still in negotiations for it. So anyway, look forward to covering the Peabody Awards. It's one of the best awards in media, and that's taking place tomorrow night at Cipriani Wall Street starting around 7 o'clock. PeabodyAwards.org, I believe, is the place you can find details on all the winners. And also, for those people in the industry, I believe the Broadcasting Cable Variety will come out with a special section about the Peabody winners in their latest issue. So, again, congratulations to everybody in the New York Dance Parade, danceparade.org. Come on down. Root for everybody. I think you'll have a fantastic time. Now in its second decade, over 10,000 dancers taking part. When we come back on Tomorrow We Televised, we're going to shift focus and tell you about a brand new PBS special, one of the most unique specials they've had in a long time, called Light Falls. It is inspired by the 100th anniversary of the certification of Albert Einstein's famous relativity theory. We will have joining us the executive producer of this special, Tracy Day, and we will have an exclusive interview with the person who is at the center of this production, the renowned physicist Brian Greene. They will both join us live after we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio and www.spreaker.com, the best internet radio on the planet, with more than 35 million listeners around the world every month and growing. BTR is your host for Talk Soap. It's the new daytime drama chat show, and it's on next Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. Talk Soap right here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. And remember, anytime you like, best BTR available for you at YouTube.com. Anytime you like, you can catch out regular episodes of our program at blogtalkradio.com/televised, the podcast version on iTunes, Apple TV, Spreaker's podcast app, and, of course, the iHeartRadio podcast network. Welcome back to the Marvy Televised on this Friday afternoon. Welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. So I'm having fun with you live from New York. 68 degrees at the top of the hour. Beautiful skies here in the New York metro area. Hopefully prelude to a fantastic weekend. Weekend of the New York Dance Parade. Weekend of the Peabody Awards. Everybody resting up from the upgrades that took place all week long. Various places around Manhattan. And we're happy to have you with us. Wonderful guests coming your way in the next half hour. We invite you, as always, to be interactive with them and us. So give us a call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's good anyway to catch us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. We also have our chat room going, SimonApple04 by hand. You can put your questions and feedback there, and you'll find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the problem's on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk or Speaker screen. Follow the instructions, other people can be live with you. Coming up on May 29th, that's a Wednesday, your local PBS station may be running a very unique special. It's called Light Falls. It's based on acclaimed theatrical production dealing with the 100th anniversary of the certification of one of the great scientific principles of all time, the Albert Einstein theory of relativity. Joining us live in an interview exclusive, first, the executive producer of this PBS special, Tracy Day. Hi, Tracy.
Hi there. How are you?
Very fine, thank you. Where are you calling from?
Calling from the Upper West Side of New York.
Well, it's happy to have you with us. And also joining us live in the area exclusive is the person who is at, you might say, the center of Light Falls. He is in his field very well liked, very well renowned, physicist Brian Greene. Brian, thank you for making the time for us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And you're also calling from New York?
Yes, I am.
Great. And Brian, we'll start with you. How did this production come to be?
Well, a couple of years ago, we recognized that theater provides a wonderful way of communicating ideas of science in a way that reaches people in a deeper, visceral, more emotional way. So by combining theater and science in a way that really amplifies the power of each, you can reach the audience in a different way. And this anniversary, this 100th anniversary of the confirmation of Einstein's general theory of relativity, provides a wonderful moment for bringing science and theater together to have a celebration, if you will, a national celebration of one of the greatest achievements of the human mind.
And this is not a dry, you know, expertise, you know, you standing before a podium with some slides about relativity. This is a full-blown production with a lot of cast. It's semi-scripted. There's a lot of interesting elements to it.
Yes, that's right. It's three actors who play the role of historical figures, people like Albert Einstein, of course, others who you probably have not heard of, but after the show you'll understand the vital role that they played, a mathematician named David Hilbert, another physicist named Max Planck, and so forth. And all the words that the actors speak as historical figures are drawn from the historical record. So the audience hears directly from the scientists themselves using the words that they themselves spoke, you know, in, you know, 100 years ago. I play the role of narrator, if you will, connecting the things that you hear from the characters and allowing the audience to go along for the very journey that Einstein himself followed as he tried to figure out the fundamental workings of the universe. So the show, in a way, really allows the audience to put themselves in the shoes of, in the mind of Albert Einstein, his confusions, his elations, his discoveries, his failures, his triumphs, and in that way you really go along for a dramatic journey of discovery. That's really what it's all about.
Tracy, how did this project come to you?
Well, Brian wrote this incredible script, and we worked together to put a creative team together. A creative team. So we reached out to 59 Productions. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they won a Tony for An American in Paris. They do these kind of amazing 3D visuals in the theater. You don't need glasses or any of that. They just sort of create a world that is very three-dimensional. So it really does have an amazing magical effect. And we reached out to Jeff Beal, who is the composer of you know, broadcasts like House of Cards. I don't know if you know that sort of iconic opening to House of Cards, the horns, that kind of memorable score, and we all came together and you know, I like to think created this magic. We then, just to turn it into broadcast, just to kind of keep going on that, we reached out to the folks at Great Performances, David Horn and his terrific team, because we wanted to collaborate and co-produce with a group of broadcast people who knew how to shoot and didn't sort of crush the magic, as sometimes happens if theater is shot for broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Brian, over the years, television has had a wonderful parade of scientists who had the great gift of communication, of communicating unique scientific principles, theories, philosophies, in ways that we could understand. You go back to the 50s, Don Herbert, the man who became known as Mr. Wizard, for many years on NBC's Watch Mr. Wizard, and then took it to Nickelodeon and other places. Or somebody like Frank Baxter, who did the Bell Science series of specials that Frank Capra, we mentioned earlier on in the series today, was also involved with. Or Albert Hibbs, did a wonderful series on NBC called Exploring, or the people behind Discovery on ABC. And more recently, Carl Sagan, who, of course, did the wonderful series Cosmos that now Fox is doing. Neil deGrasse Tyson, probably another one of the latest of communicators. Did you... check in with it. Did you decide when you took this role on to sort of look into how they communicate to bring something to your performance? Or did you decide to say, well, look at something like the stage manager in Our Town in terms of how you approached how you would be the narrator or be the central force of this production?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I have great respect for everybody who you just mentioned. But my approach is somewhat different from the approaches that have been taken in attempts to bring science across through a straight documentary, which are really the examples that you're describing, you know, documentaries that can reach a variety of ages. You know, my hope in this piece is that it really comes across as less pedagogical, less lectury, less trying to really communicate the ideas in a straightforward way. And rather, the intention is that the audience absorbs the main ideas of Einstein by virtue of being with him along the process of discovery. And that's a very different kind of experience for the audience. And therefore, it required that I find my own path, if you will, to make the material engaging, to make it exciting, and to have the pedagogy seamlessly woven into the experience so that you never feel as though you're being lectured at or you're being told things. And that's a different kind of experience, a different kind of undertaking from just about everything that I've experienced in science television before.
You are hearing physicist Brian Green, executive producer Tracy Day, from the new PBS special, Light Falls, based on the acclaimed theatrical production. And the program will be running on many PBS stations Wednesday, May 29th, 10 p.m. Pacific time. Remember, with public television, many stations will run it and premiere it at the same time. Others will wait later in the week, and some will present it and maybe replay it also on the weekends. But Tracy and Brian join us live from New York this half hour on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon, I'm with you live also from the Big Apple. We're at 68 degrees outside. It is gorgeous. Chris, and it looks like we're going to have a fantastic weekend for things like the New York Dance Parade tomorrow afternoon and the Peabody Awards being presented at Different Wall Street tomorrow night. And of course, your comment for our guests, be interactive with us. Get involved at 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. And coming up before we leave you this half hour and this Friday, we have our Up with an Update segment. We'll update you on two guests that we had in this program 4 years ago when they were hosting a game show on GSN. We'll tell you where they are at now. I think you might be very, very surprised. And if you're a fan of horror films, very delighted. Tracy, you mentioned Jeff Beal, a terrific CD composer from House of Cards and other things. And when you said that, this popped in. When Leonard Rosenman, the great composer of film and TV, did The Defenders back in the early 60s, he was asked about the theme music that he did. And he was asked originally by the producers, I want you to do a theme music that explains the law. And he said, I can't do that. That's too literal. But what I do compose, when you think of it, you will think of the law. And if you've ever seen that TV series with E.G. Marshall and Robert Reed from the early 60s, one of the great TV series about law, you hear that theme music, yeah, you think of the law. You think of the dignity and majesty of it. What kind of guidance did you give Jeff in terms of his score?
Oh, goodness. I'm not sure we gave Jeff any real guidance. I mean, Jeff is an incredibly talented, intuitive composer, and so he was involved from the very beginning at the creative meetings where we were, you know, discussing visuals, listening to the script, reading the script, and really, you know, his translation of the story into music is beautiful. I mean, he captures the emotional side of it. Science, as you know, as Brian said, is often not presented with any kind of human emotion, but this story has a lot of that. He captured the tension, he captures the elation, you know, so he really he was really able to translate some of these difficult to describe feelings into music.
Yeah. Brian, what was it like for you as a scientist to interact with actors to bring out this very special story of science?
Well, it was really a wonderful experience because, you know, with really good actors, words that I have been familiar with for a very long time, because I know the history of the discovery of general relativity quite well, they added so much life to the text that was on the page. So for me, I was already enthralled, if you would, by the progression of ideas and the tension between competitors who were trying to beat Einstein to the finish line and beat him to relativity. So there was already great tension, great drama built in to the narrative, but then to have actors add their own insight and their own emotional pulse to this drama moving forward added so much to it that to me it was really quite gratifying to watch it all come together.
Mm-hmm.
And I
think you go ahead, Tracy.
I was just going to say we haven't mentioned the actors, but it's Francesca Faradani, Michael Winther, and Brian Avers, and all three of them are Broadway actors who have also done broadcasts. So I think they, you know, they know how to kind of own a stage, and they also know how the acting needs to translate for broadcast. So they were kind of just wonderful, really wonderful to collaborate with, and you know, you'll see the product.
Yeah, Brian, was any dialogue improvised on the spot?
Well, my words are partially improvised. There are certain things that I need to say because various cues, lighting cues, sound cues, and the like are hinging upon me hitting certain words. But I prefer to have a general sense of where I'm going and allow the spontaneity of the moment to drive the specific word choices as I go forward. So it's a blending, if you will, of an overarching superstructure, things that I have got to hit, but together with interior words that I can play with on the fly, and that's how I go forward.
Yeah. And Brian, how do you deal with staging? Because as Tracy mentioned before, there's a lot of unique effects going on in, behind you, in front of you, sides of you, by the folks that did. And by the way, one credit you didn't mention was Warhorse.
Warhorse,
production
absolutely.
For Broadway several years ago that they used the special, the steel animals, the horses' heads and so forth that the actors use. So how do you deal with staging?
It's a good question. So the stage itself is quite unique. We have a screen, an opaque screen upstage at the back of the stage, and we also have a see-through screen, hologauze it's called, which is downstage. And I am downstage of both of those screens, and the actors live in the space between those two screens. And we have six projectors that are illuminating those two surfaces. And the beauty of that is you can create, as Tracy was mentioning, a parallax effect. That is a 3D effect in real time for the audience. So the visuals have the same kind of quality that I'm familiar with from hosting Nova specials, but of course there it's all green screen and post-production. Here it's in real time, so it's sort of a beautiful way of bringing ideas of curved space and warp time to life in a real 3D environment that happens in real time. Now, Scott Ferris is the director of the piece, the stage director, and he has a wonderful feel for how to integrate the two screens, the three actors, and me as the narrator, and he really uses that as his palette, and he this beautiful environment in which those elements all play off each other to maximal effect. So it's really his own vision, Scott Ferris's vision, that brings the staging to life.
Mm-hmm. Tracy, how did you decide to shoot this? Did you shoot this production with a live audience and do it straight through, or did you decide, no live audience, let's do this in chunks, and then we'll edit it all together?
No, actually, we shot it over 2 days. We had two live performances with a living, breathing audience and shot it in full both times and with no, you know, with no excerpts or no stops, no nothing.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we have a new person in our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Welcome aboard. Joining the other two people in the room. So if you have a question or comment, put it in the room so we can see it and bring it to our guests or give us a call, 646-652-2906. Don't forget anywhere you're catching us right here on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. Tracy, how does in productions like this, it's always fascinating when I watch great performances, or Live from Lincoln Center, Live from the Met, how the stage director works with the TV director. In this case, what kind of relationship did you have between stage director and TV director?
Well, you know, it's the examples you just gave, of course, are all David Horn's team. I mean, he's remarkable. So he watched what we were doing on the stage. He mapped out beautifully shots that would really work with the visuals that the live audience was seeing. It's a different visual experience because he was able to capture angles, for instance, the theater audience can't see. So even I, in watching the rough cuts, was just, I mean, I was so blown away with how creative the shooting of this was.
Mm-hmm. Light Falls, a very unique PBS special celebrating the 100th anniversary of the certification of Albert Einstein's theory of relativity, one of the great scientific principles of all time. We've got the executive producer of the program, Tracy Day, and the physicist who is at the center of the program, Brian Green. Both of us live from Nueva York this half hour on Tomorrow will be televised. The program, by the way, runs on Wednesday, May 29th, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time on many PBS stations around the country. Once again, don't forget you have to check not only the PBS station in your area playing it, but when they do. Some play it at the correct time, others delay the show till later in the week. Some play it on the weekend, others also play it twice. Premiere date, and later on the weekend. If you have a question or comment for our guests, bring it in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. The Indianapolis 500 is coming on Memorial Day weekend on NBC for the very first time, and coming up on the Marvel Televised next Friday, we'll speak with the executive producer of a new 30 for 30 special called Qualified. It deals with Janet Guthrie, the woman who broke the gender barrier at the Indy 500. What happened? Why didn't she go further than that? And where is she at now? Caroline Warlow, the producer of Qualified, joins us live a week from today, 3:30 Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Brian, do you get the chance in the production to interact with the audience? Or if you didn't, did you interact with them afterward? And what kind of feedback did you get?
Well, I do interact with them from the stage, not in a sort of goofy way, so to speak, and not in any way that really influences deeply the performance, but there are moments in which I bring them in because I know that they know certain things and I give them an opportunity to make it clear that they do. So it's not as though there's a Q&A, it's not as though there's sort of a back and forth between us, but their reactions and their momentary injection of their own knowledge does play a role in the piece.
Tracy, do you capture that at all in the show?
You know, some for sure, because part of the show, you know, live performance, to Brian's point, is that interaction. So you hear them, and you can kind of get a sense of that energy of a live audience and a live theatrical work.
Tracy, given the subject matter, is PBS doing any special outreach on behalf of the special?
They are, and we're building with them an entire education program as well, which will exist, of course, on the website. And so yes, is the short answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you mentioned earlier that you've done some television in the past, narrating specials, narrating segments of Nova, one of the best science series ever made, by the way, other PBS undertaking. What's your thoughts about where programming about science and actuality, what you used to call actuality programming, science, history, and so forth, where do you think it's at these days in this era of plentiful television, diverse television, smart TV sets and devices that allow you to interact with the programming?
Well, I think there's a lot of wonderful programming that is bringing, you know, ideas of science across. Nova, of course, is one of the pinnacle examples. And, you know, there are so many untold stories of science that deserve and need to be out there in the world. So it's not fully untapped, but there's a lot of untapped material out there that really is, for an audience, exciting and dramatic and ultimately reveals deep qualities of how the world works. So there's a lot of good stuff out there, but there's a great opportunity to bring other untold stories out to the world.
Mm-hmm. Tracy, what's next for you as an executive producer?
Well, so I run the World Science Festival. Brian Green and I co-founded it. So we do this kind of programming for live audience and for broadcast, actually, all the time. This, interestingly, you know, I come from broadcast news. I was with ABC News for many years. Did you know, covered lots of wars and presidential elections and various things, and not a lot of science, because the assumption was that science isn't interesting to a general broadcast audience. And we kind of wanted to take that and sort of prove it wrong, because if you add great storytelling and with real attention to elements beyond the sort of dry explanations, there is an audience. You know, and so we continue to probe different ways to tell these stories in every medium, from live to digital to mainstream media, and we'll continue to do that.
Mm-hmm. Brian, what do you think about the idea of science as a spin-off point for scripted programming? For example, Nat Geographic has done Genius, which has dealt with scientists. As well. Coming up, by the way, on GEO, we have The Hot Zone, the story about the Ebola epidemic with Julianne Margulies in the lead role. It was just presented at Tribeca Film Festival, and a lot of good reviews about that miniseries that Linda Oakes, who is the acclaimed theater, the acclaimed TV and film producer, is involved with. What hope do you have about scripted programming that deals with science?
Well, much as I was saying before, I think there's a rich opportunity in either format, because, look, what makes for good television? We all know that it's great stories that really grab hold of you and make you want to continue watching, that make you feel like you've gone along for a journey that's either emotional or intellectual or in some way just really grabs your attention. The stories of science are exactly that kind of story. I mean, when you're grappling with issues of reality, when you're grappling with issues of space and time and say medicine and the opportunities in nanoscience and the challenges with energy. I mean, there's so much out there that really matters. And if you find the right way of weaving those ideas into story, into narrative, it can be an enormously enriching experience on so many fronts for an audience. So, yes, there are great opportunities to bring these ideas out through a variety of formats.
And we know that can happen because a year or so ago there was a film called Hidden Figures about the mathematicians that were very much involved in the early days of NASA, and it turned to be a blockbuster hit, very well cast, Oscar nominated. And I know that I think Gio is still working on a series version of Hidden Figures. I hope they go along. I hope somebody does it because I think it'll be really fantastic and a great way to showcase science in entertaining and engaging. Anyway, Brian, by the way, before we let both of you go, are there plans to bring this theatrical production back elsewhere around the country?
Well, yes. In fact, I don't know when our conversation, I guess, is this live? I'm not even sure. If it is live. It is live.
Yes,
fantastic. So we're doing a live version of Light Falls on May 22nd. That's next Wednesday at Jazz at Lincoln Center in New York City. So if folks are interested to see it live, that's an opportunity. And, yes, there are discussions of taking this on tour throughout the country. So people should look for it. It will be around at some point.
And if you haven't gone to the Rose Hall at Jazz Lincoln Center, I've been there for many a unique presentation by different television networks when they showcase their upcoming programs. They do a great job with the staging of their shows. They really are marvelous. Light Falls, dealing with the 100th anniversary of the certification of one of the great scientific principles of all time, the theory of relativity by Albert Einstein. It happens on PBS, on many PBS stations, Wednesday, May 29th, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Check your local listings, A, for the PBS station, your area that plays the program, and when they play. Remember, some stations will delay the show, some will run it exactly when it's supposed to premiere, others will do it twice, replay as well over the weekend. For more details online, pbs.org. And again, if you want to see it in person, next week at Jazz Lincoln Center, Rose Hall, do get the chance to do it. It's a terrific production. Tracy Day, the executive producer, Brian Green, the physicist at the heart of the production. Thank you both for coming on. It's been a delight having you both aboard. All the very best to you down the road. And we'd love to have you back again. If you have another science TV project, we'd love to have you back.
Great. Thank you very much.
Terrific. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Brian. Tracy, take care. Enjoy the weekend.
Thanks.
You too.
Brian Green and Tracy Day joining us live from New Web, New York. And finally, up as an update, when we catch up on guests and topics we had in this program. 4 years ago, we brought you the horror film duo that hosted a GSN game show from Blumhouse TV called Televator. They're Jen and Sophia Skoska. Well, we found out earlier today that they have made a deal with David Cronenberg's production company to do film and TV projects for that famous filmmaker and his production outfit. So congratulations to Jen and Sylvia. We enjoyed having you on To Marvel Televised 4 years ago. If you do another TV show, we would love to have you back. Remember, coming up Monday on To Marvel Televised, we will have the one-person crew, co-star, executive producer, creator, writer, director of the new Netflix series that premiered earlier today. It's Bruno Salvan Nime. And we'll find out about his latest project announced yesterday, his new Netflix hip-hop musical movie based on Romeo and Juliet, produced in the Bushwick section of Brooklyn. And coming up on our special episode next Wednesday, second three episodes we're doing, the executive producer and famed chef of the new Facebook Watch series, Family Style, Philip Chang, and from Stage 13, the digital unit Warner Brothers, who put this show together, Vice President of Unscripted Development, Sherry Scarfa, and postponed from earlier from today, but will be with us finally, the Third Entertainment Group Chief Culture Officer, Talk University on Television, Linda Ong. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch episodes you missed, blogtoway.com says televised. Check out the podcast on iTunes, Apple TV Speaker, and the iHeartRadio app. And remember, we love hearing from you, so email me, find me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter at UEC Simon, TWBT. The Music Expresses program, those the participants, also the Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and iHeartRadio. Tomorrow we televised is brought today by Audible.com, Time Development, part of the annual New York Television Festival, and an Amazon company. Remember, or we'll transform the way you hear the world. But tomorrow we tell all right, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Have a fantastic weekend. Good luck with the folks at the Dance Parade and the Peabody Awards tomorrow night. Back on Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific. You know where, Blog Talk Radio Speaker and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're up to this weekend, please make it safe and make it great. And until next time, stay well and stay tuned.